The subject for this class, this hour, this week, is the Christian system, as Mike already announced. I'll read to you that assignment. This class is to look at the basic principles and organization of the church. Initial discussion may originate from the book by Alexander Campbell, entitled The Christian System in Reference to the Union of Christians and a Restoration of Primitive Christianity, as pled in the current Reformation. By the way, here's a copy of that book in case you want to look at it. Doesn't do much good to show you that way, but there's the Christian system. I'll show you the title page. This is what they're referring to. It's a rather elaborate piece of work. Not one that I suspect most of you will want to read, but I sure have it here in case you'd like to look at it. I loaned it to a man one time, got it back about the next day, unread. Alexander Campbell, David Evans was asking the other night, have you read much out of Millennial Harbinger? Well, I'm not sure any of us have in our time. Alexander Campbell wrote in that old style where the sentences were long and elliptical, and sometimes by the time you get to the end of a sentence, you wonder what the beginning of it was. But you're welcome to take a look at this if you'd like to. He seems to never use a short word when there was a long one available. And I think it was just the style of that day. We've got to put people in their context. And in Campbell's day, an educated man was expected to write like that. Often when they quote from Greek or Latin, they just leave it untranslated because they expect you to know the Greek and Latin as well. And I'm sitting there feeling like an idiot. And you just you really have to want to read something by Campbell to actually get through it. But it's available for you to look at if you would like to. Anyway, they said in the assignment that you may originate from the book by Alexander Campbell entitled The Christian System, etc., and conclude with a discussion of the system of worship that is outlined in the Bible. This would include not only the conduct of the assembly, but also the government, discipline, etc., that are contained in the Scriptures. The goal of this class is to make sure that the government, procedures, worship, and practices are in conformity with the Scriptures. So that's the assignment that we have for this week. My assignment for last week was the history of the church, as I hope you know if you were here. And at the end of the session on Friday, we were talking about a question of rather contemporary concern. My assignment was to talk about the early years on Monday, and then the apostasy on Tuesday, the Reformation on Wednesday, the Restoration on Thursday, and on Friday, the modern era. We did it in that order and sort of on those days. On Friday, we were talking about our modern era, and we were talking about a man that some of us knew by the name of Carl Ketcherside. And a number of people after that class was over asked if we could have, beginning this morning, some supplementary material regarding him because I didn't plan my time as well as I wish I had. So I said that that would be okay with me, and the elders said that that was okay with them. So we want to begin this morning in fulfilling of that promise to talk a little bit more about some of the things we were talking about at the end of class on Friday, and especially to document some of the things that I said, and also to talk about a couple of issues which I touched on but didn't really get to flesh out to the place where maybe they were as understandable as they should have been. And I don't want to repeat things that I said on Friday. Part of my problem there is I'm not sure what I said to people individually, and I'm not sure what I said in the class. And I'm not sure what I didn't say, but just thought about saying. So I hope you can bear with me on that. I do want to give a disclaimer, as I gave on Friday, but a number of you weren't here on Friday, that I wouldn't be talking about this because I know it's such a sensitive issue and can be a personal issue for some of you and some of your families. My concern is that those who don't learn from the past are often condemned to repeat it, as the old adage goes. So therefore, I believe it's worth taking the risk, and I believe that enough time has gone by now that we can have a sense of perspective and a degree of objectivity about this. And I said Friday that those of us who are older and who knew Carl need to realize that we have a generation of younger people now to whom Carl is just a historical figure, not a contemporary figure at all. So the past and the present are all connected on the same rope. If somebody pulled the rope 50 years ago, we may still feel that pull now. And Carl pulled our rope. We need to understand what that was about. There's a lesson to be learned from our experience with Carl, and that is my sole reason for dwelling on this, not to make anybody feel bad or upset. But the problems that we have in the church are never new. They're always the same old problems, just recirculating over and over again. This has been true since the first century, and it's true in the 21st century. I know that this can be sensitive because some of you knew Carl. In fact, a number of people here knew him. And I take full responsibility for the fact that I have even chosen to mention him. I was given an assignment to talk about the modern era, but no names were mentioned in that. This is my responsibility and should not be construed otherwise, and the congregation here should not be blamed for anything that I say or do. As I said in the conclusion of the disclaimer, it's one thing if we say something about Luther or Campbell because we didn't know them. Nobody in the audience knew them. If we're talking about somebody that some of us knew, then it's more personal, and I certainly understand that. Now, I'm not going to run through all the material that we talked about on Brother Ketcher's side last week, but I did mention that he became an elder when he was 28 years old. When he was 26 years old. And I said that that seems to me to be rather young for the eldership. Reference 1 Timothy 3 and what it says about not being a novice, lest being lifted up with pride you fall into the condemnation of the devil. Somebody asked me about that. They said they'd never heard from any other source that Carl was an elder when he was 26 years old. So I have a page here of the Ketcher Side Porter debate. I introduced this debate to you the other day. Maybe I better pick that up because you'll be reading it while I introduce it. The Ketcher Side Porter debate was held over in the community building at Ozark, built by the WPA. It was a brand new building at that time. This was in 1937. Carl was 28 years old. Carl selected as his moderator for that debate W.G. Roberts, who is an uncle of Richard Riggins. Brother Roberts estimated that there were never less than 1,000 people there any of the four nights of that debate. And in talking about this, I should just mention to you that in 1937, we were still using stenographers rather than tape recorders to record what was said in debate. Magnetic tape for recording sound had been invented in Germany in 1928, but it wasn't very good, and due to the hostilities leading up to World War II and all through the war, it wasn't widely known to the rest of the world. So as the war drew to a close, about 6 of the German recording machines were captured, and they were tested, but they had a lot of background noise, and they were worse than a 78 RPM shellac record. Distortion was very high. So it took a long time. Bing Crosby was instrumental in getting this perfected, and there was a demonstration made for him eventually, and it was a big success, and led to the development of the first use of audio, the audio tape recorder that was produced in the U.S. The first machine was used by ABC in 1948, and not many years after that, the brethren began to purchase those great big old reel-to-reel tape recorders, and we'd see those sitting in the front of meeting houses to record speeches. But in 1937, we were still dependent upon stenographers, and some of them were very good. Often there'd be two or three working together to be sure they got everything right. The Ketcher Side Porter debate of 1937 was about institutionalism, colleges, and those types of things. And I mentioned to you, Rue Porter was 47 years old. He'd held a couple of dozen public debates. Carl was 28 years old, and this was his first debate. And it was a big deal at the time. It was written up in the Springfield newspaper, and there were articles and even pictures from that. Anyway, this was a statement that was made in that debate by Carl. He's reading a letter that he had from the congregation at Nevada, up the road here where he was a member at that time. The only thing I wanted to read to you was down here at the bottom. Brother Ketcher Side has been a member of the congregation in Nevada for approximately 8 years. That's since he was 20. He got married when he was 20 and they moved down there. And has been an elder of the church for about 2 years, which would make him an elder at the age of approximately 26. So that's where I got that piece of information. If the stenographers got it right, then that's what was said at that debate. I wanted to emphasize a couple of things that I think I touched on and didn't really get to flesh out. One of them was the idea of the mantle of a one-man leadership of the church that is passed down from generation to generation. When Alexander Campbell died, one man who heard of it fell on the floor saying, It is not that he is gone that I am grieved, but that his mantle must fall upon my unworthy shoulders. The idea of the mantle was among us very early. Obviously, it comes from the Old Testament about Elijah and Elisha. Elisha got the mantle that Elijah had worn. And the idea is the authority or the responsibility or some combination of those two. Now, it perplexes me that this idea of the mantle for the leadership of the church ever entered the church. I'm not sure where it came from. We sure didn't get that out of the Bible. All you and I can do is repeat what the apostles and prophets said, and if any man speak, let him speak as the oracles of God. But in Carl's autobiography, he said that Daniel Sommer told him that Daniel Sommer had hoped that his mantle would fall on Carl's shoulders. He said that Sommer told him that. In the debate from 1937, which was an earlier time, closer to the time of that conversation with Daniel Sommer, therefore possibly more accurate, in that debate he didn't use the word mantle, but the idea is definitely there. And I'll read to you from page 160 of the printed edition of that debate. He's talking about a conversation that he had in Springfield. This was in Ozark, so he says, in Springfield, only 16 miles from here, that Brother Sommer told me, Carl, we no longer need to fight these innovations. Near the end of his life, Daniel Sommer changed his mind about some things. He told me, Carl, we no longer need to fight these innovations, and we can safely go with them. And that's when I had to separate from him. Carl speaking of Daniel Sommer. I loved him as much as I've ever loved any man. I would perhaps not be here tonight defending the Word of God had it not been for His kindness, and perhaps my mother might still be placing her trust in the commandments of men had it not been for His winning way and His manner of presenting the love of Christ. But all of these things are as nothing when a man turns his back upon the revelation of God's will and the faith which he so nobly proclaimed before. I tell you, Brother Porter, as I tell this audience tonight, I shall ever be like Abraham Lincoln. I'll stand with any man who stands right. I'll stand with him as long as he stands right. And I'll part from him when he goes wrong. You have paid glowing tribute to Daniel Sommer, the man who has taught me most of what I know about these issues. Side by side, we fought for the truth of God until he started to endorse the position that my respondent endorses by fraternizing and fellowshipping with those men who have tried to sell the Church of Christ down the river. I have been opposing him since the day that the paper of which he is senior editor offered a compromise with those things which he has always opposed. I will continue to oppose every such action with every drop of blood in my body, though personally he is still dear to me. My sacred obligation is to my God and not to any man upon this earth. Brother Sommer has oft times remarked how he was the oldest and I the youngest preacher in the brotherhood. He stood with his arm about my shoulder and mentioned the fact lovingly when he was last in my humble home. I have a letter in my briefcase which he wrote to me wherein he said that he wanted me to prepare to take his place. He wanted me to prepare to take his place. Now, what was his place? Well, he was what Leroy Garrett called in his history book on the Campbell Stone movement an editor bishop. I don't know if Leroy coined that term, but I think it's an apt term to describe what was occurring. An editor bishop. He said he wanted me to prepare to take his place when he had crossed the Dusky River. I think he said he was about my age when Benjamin Franklin said the same to him. And this is why I trace this line. From Alexander Campbell in one generation, to Benjamin Franklin in the next generation, to Daniel Sommer in the next generation, and then to Carl in his generation. Four men, each standing for their generation, upon whom that mantle was supposed to go. I'll just show you this picture to document it. He said that he was about my age when Benjamin Franklin said the same to him. Right down here on page 160 of that debate. Well, this points up a very important issue for us to consider, and we were talking about this at the end of class on Friday. I had a couple of statements from Duane Stoops that he handed me through the week, or they were in the question box or something. He said, a powerful leader like Alexander Campbell is a mixed blessing or curse of the highest order. And obviously it's both. A man like Alexander Campbell, a man like Carl Ketcherside, they do a tremendous amount of good, do and did a tremendous amount of good. There are people in this room for whom Carl did a tremendous amount of good. So I don't want to short shrift that side of it. But there's also this grave danger here. Duane also gave me a piece of paper that talks about the practice of a one-man pulpit versus the practice of a one-man pen. Which is worse? The one-man pulpit is power over a congregation, while the one-man pen is power over the brotherhood. And we're back to the exercise of authority and power and control through the use of church papers. Example, while Ketcherside was swinging the dagger of dogma against the one-man pulpit over congregations, he was practicing the dangerous domination over a brotherhood by a one-man pen. And there is some truth in that. I appreciate that those pieces of paper from Brother Duane. He became our champion in debate. He became the teacher of the St. Louis Bible reading every year. He was the charismatic exhorter. He was the man who had baptized more people than probably anyone else among us at the time, keeping a running tally of that. He was the editor of his paper. And more slowly, over time, he accumulated a great deal of power. The St. Louis Bible reading began at Manchester Avenue in St. Louis in 1938. Brother Moore was showing me a picture the other day that was taken when he was there. There were pictures on the screen Sunday. Last Sunday, the Sunday before yesterday, that were taken at that place as well, I think. And some of you were there. I will read you a little statement that came out of Carl's autobiography, which he began writing in 1976. It appeared in monthly installments in Leroy Garrett's Restoration Review. And there's an interesting study there. In just the names of Leroy Garrett's periodicals. The name of his first periodical was Bible Talk, and it was supposed to be about the Bible. Later, the name changed to Restoration Review, and it was about the Restoration. It was emphasizing the goals of the founders and so forth of the Restoration movement, taking in essence, I think there, if I may say so, a step away from the Bible, putting the Restoration between us and the Bible. Anyway, this was published in March of 1978 in the Restoration Review, in one of those installments of what was later put together as Carl's autobiography. Here's what Carl had to say about the time that we're talking about. In January of 1948, we had 85 students from 10 states enrolled in the study of the Word in St. Louis. It was a great learning experience, and we explored the Bible with a keen sense of desire for knowing more about the divine revelation. For 6 weeks, we studied every day and held 3 night sessions of 2 hours each. We drew so close together that we wept when the time came to bid one another farewell. Young preachers of the gospel, here's one sitting on the front row here, who was there, I think, in 1948, yes. Young preachers of the gospel, capable and eager, were rising up from every direction. Congregations which had always opposed us were switching their allegiance. In many older places, record crowds were being registered. If I were to select the period in the 20th century when the party with which I was allied reached its peak, I would say it would be that time approaching the year 1950. We were confident, united, aggressive, and fearless. We were ready and anxious to debate anyone who differed with us on any question. That's Carl's estimation of that particular period of time. His influence was growing by leaps and bounds. I can say to you that I don't think I've never known anybody with any more personal magnetism and charisma than Carl Ketcherside, and that he evidently had at the height of his powers. I've been told by a number of people that when he would walk into a room, every head turned and attention would focus on him. I cannot explain how that occurs. They say that Alexander Campbell was the same way. I quoted to you about Campbell last week, that he was just passing by one day and a man who had no idea who he was said, "There goes a man with brains enough to govern Europe." I think to some extent they were just born that way. It's a certain kind of person, and I cannot explain that. Maybe you can. But there's apparently something in the bearing, in the carriage, in the appearance, and electricity. Maybe it is involved in the extremely self-assured manner of these men. I don't mean that everybody was affected by them in this way. One lady said that Carl was the most overbearing man she'd ever met, and she was not a particular fan of his. Brother Basinger said of Carl, "I never could see what the fuss was all about." Can't you just hear him saying that? But apparently nobody could ignore him. He made an impression on everybody. Dwayne Stoops, when he was a little boy attending at Manchester Avenue in St. Louis, where Carl had his membership, around 1944 or so, when Dwayne was in kindergarten, about the age of five, Carl was not usually there. He was usually speaking someplace else. But Dwayne remembers very vividly one Sunday night that Carl came to Manchester Avenue, stepped in through the door, and everybody flocked around him. And Dwayne could tell there was something different about him than there was about everybody else. And as Carl began to move down the aisle, this clump of people around him moved with him right down the aisle. And when Carl got up to speak and his voice began to boom out, little Dwayne Stoops, sitting there in the pew, thought, "Is that God? That must be God." Literally thought that. It's an amazing thing to think about. He became the Brotherhood Defender. And the chilling thing about this is it wasn't just little five-year-old children that felt this way. My grandfather up at Braemar, his name was George Phillips, he was an elder of the church in Braemar for many years. He told me that one time during the era of Carl's trouble with D.A. Sommer, that a man actually said to my grandfather, I'll follow Carl Ketcherside right or wrong. It just makes the goose pimples run up and down my spine to even quote that to you. I'll follow Carl Ketcherside, right or wrong. But I never knew my grandfather to lie to me about anything else, so I've got to at least assume that somebody actually said that to him. The problem between Carl and D.A. in the late 40s originated, or at least the thing that got the credit for the initializing of that problem, was an article that D.A. Sommer wrote in the Macedonian Call called Suppose. Because a lot of people could see the direction that things were headed with Carl's influence. Some people thought maybe D.A. wanted the mantle himself instead of Carl having it. I don't know about that, and I don't need to determine that. I'll read you a few lines of the Suppose article. Suppose that I act in such a way, this was in October 1946, Macedonian Call. Suppose that I act in such a way that a very many of my brethren conclude that I am as much interested in preaching myself as instead of preaching Christ alone. Suppose that I plan to bring all preaching brethren and writers possible under obligations to me, and by my plans have churches, even with elders, turn the selecting of their preachers, singers, Bible teachers, etc., over to me, and take such general supervision that even my enemies call me archbishop. Suppose I tell a brother that I expect to work only with key places, if possible. Skipping down a little ways, he says, and then suppose that I tell brethren that if they'll put the brotherhood in my hands, I'll get it somewhere. And in the opinion of many, I am working to that end. So much so that many leaders are anxious and alarmed when so many straws show which way the wind is blowing. Is it not time for all the brothers and sisters to awaken out of their infatuation and open their eyes before it is too late and before they find themselves bound hand and foot by me? Now, this was written in 1946. It was long before the fellowship issue arose. The first Thoughts on Fellowship article appeared in Mission Messenger in 1957. So this is in 1946, over 10 years before that. Yes, I might get the brotherhood somewhere, but where? It takes more than talent and zeal to get the church somewhere in the sense of a scriptural and permanent where. It takes experience, judgment, humility. It takes the spirit of Paul when he said of himself, serving the Lord with all humility of mind. Even the best Christians are weak, and hence I think each one of us, preachers and all others, should daily offer such a simple prayer as this. Lord, help me that I may never reproach thy holy name, that I may have wisdom to do all things aright, and that I may be faithful to the simplicity in Christ, and that I may always be humble before thee and without guile. It's a bit hard to read that. Anyway, when this article appeared in 1946, it created a great stir or furor among the brethren. And it was like people were picking sides. Are you on Carl's side? Are you on D.A.'s side? And the churches were lining up behind one or the other. Congregations were, in some cases, having considerable difficulties over this. Brother Sommer saw the problem that I've been describing to you where Carl was concerned, maybe though he was not able to deal with it in the right spirit all the time. Maybe that's a matter of opinion. I sort of like my grandfather's approach to this problem up at Bramer, sort of an isolated congregation up in the country. But a man asked my grandfather, which side of the Sommer Ketcher side trouble is the church at Bramer on? And he said, we're not on either side of it, and we're not going to have either one of those men here to Bramer until they get their problem solved. And he also said if every congregation would take that approach, then they'd settle it pretty quickly. And that may not be the right solution in every situation, but I think in that particular case, it might have helped. One of Carl's failings, in my opinion, was that he was enamored of people with lots of formal education. I think the reason he was that he did not have it himself. And sometimes people who don't have much formal education themselves put an undue stock in those who do. That's one reason for going to college. You go to college, you find out just how meager it really is. Isn't that the truth? You just find out what it is, and then you don't have to worry about it the rest of your life. But sometimes people who didn't go to college, they feel like there's just something wonderful there in college that I missed. Those of us who went know what it is. So Carl did not go, and was always sort of enamored of people that had. Leroy Garrett, I think, was in this same category with him. Leroy Garrett was Carl's fast friend through the 50s and on through the remainder of Carl's life. Leroy Garrett was a high school dropout, but he wanted to prove that a high school dropout could get a PhD from Harvard, and he thinks maybe he's the only one who ever went and did that. Well, Carl was sort of enamored of Leroy because Leroy had this doctorate, and Leroy was enamored of Carl because of Carl's magnetism and ability, and so they became fast friends and fought battles shoulder to shoulder. Carl went over to England in 1947 and again in 1951. But on that first trip in England in particular, he got out of his little world in America for the first time. It would seem perhaps that he was somewhat overawed by some of the people there in England that he met. He began to want to be more cosmopolitan and didn't want to be guilty of provincialism. One thing about Carl was he always seemed to have an idea that he was pushing at the time, long before the fellowship issue ever arose. There was always a tangent that he was on that would sort of spice things up. I told you he was a salesman. It slices, it dices. We've got to have something to spice things up. When he came back from England, he was absolutely sold on the idea of close communion. Close communion was the serving of the Lord's Supper to only those that we were in fellowship with and who we thought should have the Lord's Supper. It ignored the idea that the supper is the Lord's and that we neither invite nor debar. It's a personal issue whether you take the Lord's Supper or not. But Carl was deciding, as many of the congregations in England did at that time, and some still do, who should have the Lord's Supper. And it was said by people who witnessed this that sometimes he would pass the emblems and practically be jumping over the pews to be sure that the wrong people didn't get a hold of the Lord's Supper. Well, he'd get on a kick like this. That's just one example. He'd get on a kick like that, and he'd teach on it everywhere. And it was the issue. Carl Landis told me, and this was Wilfred's father, Carl Landis told me one time, because Carl was at 26th and Spruce in Kansas City, served in the eldership there, that one time Carl Ketcherside was holding a meeting and staying in Carl Landis's home, and had talked about the last three nights on the issue of the smoking of tobacco, just hammered it hard every night, three nights in a row. Carl Landis said that when we got home, I told him, well, Carl, you've hammered this for three nights now. Maybe tomorrow night you should go on to another subject. But Carl Ketcherside would get on a tangent, whether it was anti-smoking or closed communion, and just be real, real strong on it for a while. It was his theme for a while. He'd get on a kick and just teach it everywhere. And when very few people would pick up on a particular tangent, then he would just drop it. What I'm saying to you is that Carl always tended to be extreme. He'd only come back to balance when nobody or not enough people followed what he was saying. For a while, it was the public work of women in the church. And for a while, it was an extreme application of mutual ministry, where every man in the congregation, no matter who he is or no matter what abilities he lacks, he's obligated to get up and edify the body. He was real strong on that for a while. For a while, it was the work of the Holy Spirit that he was real strong on. When Carl went to the centennial at Old Scotland in 1956, because Old Scotland started in 1856. When he went there in 1956, Irvin Skinner, who was Dixie Rogers' father, told me that he could see that Carl was already slipping. He was real strong on the work of the Holy Spirit at that time. Hubert Long, whom many of you knew, told me about that same period of time. He said that Carl was talking about the Holy Spirit as if the Spirit would just pick you up and move you around, was the way Hubert Long put it. Anyway, he'd get on one tangent or another. Didn't matter too much what the subject was, but he'd get on a tangent and just ride that tangent, and he acted like he had a one-track mind. He would always get stuck on one thing or another. Finally, the tangent was fellowship. The first Thoughts on Fellowship article appeared in the Mission Messenger in January of 1957. And by that time, too many people among us just thought Carl was the be-all and end-all of the church. Too many people easily went along with him on this. Too many people wanted it to be true. And never forget that if you want something to be true, it's easy to convince yourself that it is true. It's not just a matter of pure intellectuality in making these decisions. Our emotions get involved in these decisions as well. And we need to be wise enough to sort that out. So many people wanted this to be true. I want to be able to believe that my relatives are saved and all that type of thing. They wanted it to be true, and consequently they found that they could believe it. I have known of people who got tape recordings of Carl and listened to them over and over again until they could believe it. They didn't believe it when they started out, but they listened to it long enough that they found that they could believe it. All those years of skinning the sects, as it used to be called, breeded an equal and opposite reaction. And there was change coming in the air during those years of prosperity in the late 50s. This issue of ecumenism was already beginning to be in the air, and I think Carl picked up on that. It was the spirit of the age, the zeitgeist, if you will, of the time. So I believe the fellowship issue would have been an issue among us, even if Carl had never lived. But he picked it up, and with his tremendous influence, with his considerable ability, he gave it a great impetus, and by the force of his personality, he gave it a credibility that it would not have otherwise had. And that's the thing I'm decrying here. Now, the idea at first on fellowship was that I'm not changing any of my positions, I'm not changing any of my convictions. I'm just going to be in fellowship. It was a change in the area of tolerance, in other words. I'll be in fellowship with people with a wide range of beliefs and practices, and then I'll be able, since I'm in fellowship with them, I'll be able to study with them and bring them around to the Lord's way. Debates just aren't the way to go anymore, he was saying. Now, Carl had held a number of debates. Some of them, at least four of them, made their way into print, and some of you may have read them. The first Catcherside Wallace debate was the most printed one, maybe on the shelves of many homes who are here. But Carl said, debates aren't the way to go anymore. If we're not split before the debate, we're always split after the debate. They just create more animosity. They're just two bantam roosters fighting each other, and they never change anybody's mind. It's just it's like a contest, like a football game. So the debates aren't the way to go. Now we're just going to embrace everybody and love them into the Lord's way as found in the Bible. That was the ideal. And as I said, he had the ability to aggrandize things and make it sound like this is the way to go and get people all enthused about it. And that does sound like a wonderful ideal in a sense. But in practice, it turned out far different from that. The people of Carl's generation, those who were as old as he was, tended to stay with the truth better. But their children, the next generation that was coming on, took what Carl taught about fellowship and just scattered everywhere. Because they got the sense that Carl was saying that it's all right to go to the Baptist church, go to the Assembly of God, go wherever you want to go. They're all in Christ anyway. I don't know that Carl was actually ever really saying that, but that's the way they took what he said. And this is what I saw happening when I was a boy. My grandparents went to 59th and Kenwood in Kansas City, and the people just scattered. The best place that they went was the liberal churches of Christ, but many went to the Christian church, the Baptist church, Assemblies of God. Relatives of mine went to these various places, and eventually 59th and Kenwood in Kansas City went out of existence as a congregation, because really, if what they came to believe was true, there was no reason for them to exist. There was no reason for them to be as a separate entity trying to just go by just the Bible. They felt like if they could be saved all these other places as well, there was no reason to stand against that anymore. So many congregations were split. Many were affected by this. James River Chapel, just up the road. If you go up Main Street, it becomes CC, and you can see James River Chapel there. That grew out of this traumatic time in the church here at Nixa. And by the way, since I've mentioned them, I just want to say that I know nothing whatsoever about what goes on at James River Chapel now. I'm not accusing it of anything now. I'm not saying anything bad against it now. I'm really glad, for purposes of this discussion, that I am in blissful ignorance of what they're doing at James River Chapel. I just simply do not know. But I know that at the time, it came out of this movement and started in 1961, because a long time on the front of their building, they had the date 1961. Now they have the date 1830 on there. So I guess they started earlier than they thought they did. But they're still there. There are still people meeting there. And I just want the younger people to be aware of some of the background of this, without casting aspersion or innuendo any more than has to be. The bottom line on this is that we need strong, godly elders who will watch for the souls of the saints. Why didn't Carl's elders rein him in when he started on some of these things? Well, I'll just have to leave that question hanging in the air, but it's worth thinking about. Every evangelist, and I think every evangelist, especially as he ages perhaps, needs to be under a strong eldership who can handle him and his particular foibles and flaws. Anything that puts danger in the way of the brethren's souls is not safe for them. We don't have any right to risk the souls of our brethren by exposing them to things, or by endorsing, or even seeming to endorse, things which are not right, or encouraging association with people who practice these things. I see the Lord's church as a dove flying in the midst of vultures, and they will pick her off if they possibly can. That's just the nature of vultures and hawks. We need strong, well-grounded elders who did do a lot in many places in those times. Those were the places that tended to stand firm. But why didn't Carl's own elders rein him in? Or why did we just all change our mind on fellowship at the same time? It just baffles me. Somebody had to stand, and a number of brethren did stand. They were often accused of being hard to get along with, but you have to stand, and having done all, stand. If somebody hadn't stood against instrumental music, for example, in 1889, as Daniel Sommer did, then what kind of a church would we have today to pass on to our children? We wouldn't have anything left. We'd have to start all over. One time I asked Carl, and this was in 1977, Carl, if I raise my children in an environment where they're in constant religious association with those who use instrumental music, aren't I giving them, at the very least, the wrong impression? Now, I may be able to keep the convictions that I reached while I was not in fellowship with those people, but won't it be a problem for my children, and won't I have trouble with them? He said, all he said was, well, you're going to have trouble with your children no matter what, which was a non-answer, but there is no answer to that question. There's no good answer to it. Let me read you something that I think is very sad. Carl died in May of 1989, about 23 years ago. And this little article appeared in Leroy's paper, The Restoration Review, in December of 1991. So it's about 2.5 years after Carl had died. I'll just put it here, you can see it. Whoops. It's counterintuitive. Oh, I forgot what I'm supposed to do. Oops. Sorry. I just thought you might want to see it. There you can see it. The bulletin from Oak Hill Chapel. Now, this was a congregation that Carl was instrumental in beginning in St. Louis, and he met there with them for decades. Carl was always an advocate of mutual edification. He always opposed instrumental music and carried on with most of the same things that he'd always taught among us. The fellowship thing was the main difference. But Leroy wrote this in his paper 2.5 years after Carl died. The bulletin from Oak Hill Chapel in St. Louis, Carl Ketcherside's old congregation, had Carl's picture in a recent issue announcing the publication of his autobiography. The same issue told how the congregation now uses instrumental music. What does that mean? It means they kept instrumental music out of respect to Carl as long as he lived, But they wouldn't keep it out of respect to God and his silence in the scriptures. That's what it means, as I interpret it. The same issue told how the congregation now uses instrumental music along with a brief history of the organ and how it was made. It is ironic that the church Carl started and nurtured through its struggling years now practices what he always opposed. I don't agree with this next sentence. Leroy says, I doubt that it would be a big deal to Carl. Leroy knew him a lot better than I do, but I would think that that type of thing would have given Carl pause posthumously had he known about it. I doubt that it would be a big deal to Carl if it did not disturb the peace of the church. I understand that a few did leave for conscience sake, but the church will go on and work to the glory of God. But with an organ, it will in no wise any longer be considered a church of Christ. Leroy means it won't be considered by people a church of Christ. I just wonder, don't you, how God looks at that. What do you have to do to get your candlestick removed? I think this is a very sad little vignette and a very telling thing, because now we can see from experience where these things led. We couldn't see it in the late 50s and early 60s. We hadn't lived this experience yet. But now we see where it led. Congregations going out of existence, and when Carl's influence was waning as he aged and eventually died, there was no longer this force of personality to keep things together, and it's just been a really sad situation. The young men among us need to remember that when you participate publicly and you show that you have some ability, people are going to rate your work too highly. They want to encourage you in the work. They want to help you. And sometimes they do things that do something other than help you. Brethren, we do need to encourage our young men. I'm not saying that we don't. We do need to praise them when they do well. But we also need to be sure that we do not ruin them through this process. This is a very important thing, and I think takes wisdom and judgment to just know what to do. I remember Wilford Landis many years ago, more than 40 years ago. I was standing by the water fountain in the lobby at the Gregory Boulevard Church. Many of you have been there and know right where I was. And I had just spoken on that Sunday morning. Wilford happened to be there. And he came up to me, and I had spent a lot of time with Wilford, worked at him, leading singing for him in his meeting sometimes, and had grown up just almost a stone's throw away from him, played with his kids. So I knew Wilford very well. I'd been in VBSs with him, worked with him in those things. So he was saying this in the context of the relationship that we had together for years. He said, after I had just spoken that morning, he said, "Rick, the Lord has blessed you with ability, and people are going to praise you to the skies. Don't let it go to your head." And then he just turned around and walked off. I had many conversations with Wilford where he just said something and then he would leave. You know, and it must have been memorable because I still remember it. But that was a very good and wise thing for him to do for me at that point. Very good and wise. And I deeply appreciate him and others who have said that type of thing to me through the years. We need to find a way to encourage our young men. And if we see pride developing or if there's any tendency toward that, we need to deal with it however it needs to be dealt with. Some of these people, I would think, just a little laughing at them might have helped. I've seen some things done where people get sanctimonious. If it was just us here, I would give you an example. But since this is going to be available for anybody in the world to hear, I feel like I can't do it. But I've just seen some things done in front of a congregation, and I look around at the audience. I think, why am I only I'm the only one laughing at this? We just if somebody starts to take himself too seriously, we need to be sure that nobody else takes him too seriously. Maybe some laughter is in order, and maybe the point will be gotten in that way. Well, I'll just conclude this section by mentioning something that happened where Carl's father was involved. Carl's father was named William Ketcherside. He was a lead miner and moved his family around to many of the places that I mentioned to you on Friday. But But he became an evangelist in the church, came into the church late and became an evangelist. He was doing some canvassing out in California in 1940. This was right after Daniel Sommer died. Remember I told you on Friday that Sommer lived from 1850 to 1940, achieved the age of 90 years in a day when most people died far sooner than that. Life expectancy was a lot lower than it is now. But he was a strong man, died in 1940, and he had been the one with the mantle among us. That was well understood, well known. So William Ketcherside was doing some canvassing in the Long Beach area, and he came onto the house. He didn't know he was there, but he knocked on the door of a man who had been a leader in the church, and there had been a split there. Now he was an elder in a different group of Churches of Christ. And so he opened up the door, and there was William Ketcherside standing there, and of course they knew each other. They didn't know they were going to be seeing each other, but he opened up the door, and there stood William Ketcherside. And this was right after Daniel Sommer died. And so this elder of this other group said, "Well, I see where your leader died." William Ketcherside stood and looked at him and said, "Yes, and if you'll read a little further in the same book, you'll see where he rose again." We just need to remember who our leader is. If we can keep that in mind, I don't think we'll have too much trouble. All right, anybody got any questions or thoughts over anything that we've been speaking of so far? I appreciate your kind indulgence and your attention to this. Marvin, go ahead.
I grew up going to Manchester Avenue in college there. I heard him say one time that he made a statement at some point that he could, if he wanted to make people laugh, he could make them laugh. If he wanted to make them cry, he could make them cry. Right in the same sermon, whatever the emotion, he wanted to pull out a noise, he had the ability to do that.
Yes, he certainly did. He had the ability to, as he said, dip his brush, well, I won't quote it the way he said it, but dip his tongue, use his tongue as a brush. And yeah, I mentioned that on Friday, that he could have people laughing one minute and crying the next. He's a very entertaining speaker to listen to. Thank you, Marvin, for that firsthand account. Yes, Lisa.
What was the first name of Porter that Carl read in
your book? Yes, Rue Porter, R-U-E. His nephew from Neosha wrote a biography of Rue Porter called Uncle Rue, which you might enjoy reading. I don't have it to show you, but I don't know if it's out. It's probably, no, I couldn't bring everything. I don't think I have it with me. I didn't know we were going to be talking about these things. But Rue Porter was a very interesting man in his own right. But they say that after that debate, he said he'd never debate Carl again. Carl was that good. From the way I hear it, I obviously wasn't there. Anybody else wanted to come? Yes, go ahead.
I might mention all of his published debates are on John Morris's website.
Oh.
Doctrine.
I didn't know that. Yes. You mean the whole text is there?
Yeah.
Okay.
I scanned all of those books.
Oh, so you put them on
there. I don't think John has them all uploaded to his site yet.
Okay.
They're available in a digital form.
Okay. Well, that would be the Ketcherside Porter debate. So this is online. I didn't know what I've been showing you here. It's online. You can find those pages and look at them yourself if you want to. And that would also include then the 1952 debate with G.K. Wallace. Some of you who, I don't know if there's anybody here now who was at that. Albert Dowdy told me last week that he was at that. Bill Norman, who was here with us all last week, was at that as a young man. And then the next year they debated in St. Louis, called the Wallace Ketcherside St. Louis debate, and that was got into print. And then also, I think maybe the year after that, he debated a man by the name of Colley, C-O-L-L-E-Y. And he made a play on Brother Colley's name during the debate about being a shepherd dog and all this. These debates were kind of entertaining. Anyway, those would be the four that I know of that were in print. So if you've got those online, you're way ahead of me. Oh, Tom.
You were talking about how Leroy's paper changed names.
Yes.
I remember one of the articles in Restoration Review was about how the Mormons liked Restoration.
Yes.
And let the Mormons have Restoration.
Yeah.
So he basically gave up the title of his second paper.
So,
he saved for the next few minutes.
Leroy was if he's still living, he would be 92 years old this coming November if he's still alive. I have not heard that he died. He is? Okay. I wouldn't necessarily hear if he did die, and that's why I was wondering. But he was an interesting but not always a very stable man. Often lots of changes with Leroy. I can remember there was a time when Leroy believed that every woman ought to have something on her head in the assembly. Well, he didn't believe that very long, but there were a number of things like that. He was just not as stable as some people, I'll put it that way. And yes, he changed his emphasis further before Carl did, really. Yes, Richard?
I have not read any of the historic debates, that is, those before my time, but I have read some of them that were in my memory. And it seemed by that time they had grown into nothing more than a personal vendetta against the opponent.
Yeah.
Did they ever have any higher status?
Oh, well, not really. I mean, the nature of debating is, on the human level, the debate system is apparently thought to be the best that we can devise on the human level. We use it politically, we use it in school, we use it in court. It's called the adversarial system. When you go to court, it's not as though anybody there really cares about the truth. They're not required to care about the truth. That's not what the court is about. The judge is there to see that the law is followed. The prosecutor is there to get a conviction. The defense is there to get an acquittal or a mistrial or a hung jury or to make a deal. I'm not saying there's nobody there who ever cares about the truth in court, but I'm just saying that the love of the truth is not necessary for that system to function. There's not necessarily anybody there who cares about the truth. And the truth can sometimes seem almost irrelevant in court. And the same is true with any debating format, I think. Now, I've never been to a religious debate. I know that some of you have. So I don't know how qualified I am to even comment on Richard's question. But years ago, I did read quite a number of debates, or at least what purported to be transcripts of debate, and I assume that they were generally accurate. There's a definite skill to debating. A good debater can take either side of the issue at hand and almost make you like it. And that's a red flag to me. There's a skill involved in this. Yes, go ahead.
Carl's last debate, I think, was in Milwaukee, Oklahoma.
Okay.
With the people from the college.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a quasi-debate because that took place, I believe, in 1958, and Carl had already passed the point where he really wanted to debate. So Carl and Leroy were there, and Seth Wilson and Don DeWelt from the Christian Church over in Joplin were down there in Nowata as well. And yes, an entirely different tenor to it then. Carl is embracing these people whether they ever change their mind on the instrumental music or not. So I don't know if I would even characterize that as a debate. It was a discussion, and Carl got to the place where he liked to have two position papers presented on different points of view and then throw it open for questions from the audience. But he didn't call them debates anymore. Yeah, good point. So with this adversarial system, I'm not sure that it was ever really a very good way to get to the truth. We are told to earnestly contend for the faith, and maybe there's a place for debating, maybe not. Maybe we should just lock the two guys up in a room together so they don't have an audience. See, this is the thing. You get guys, and every male has a male ego, and it's hard enough to eat crow when you're just talking to your wife, but are you going to eat? You're going to eat crow when you're talking to 1,000 people? Many people have continued in debate when they knew they were wrong because it's just so hard to admit it. So I'm not sure it was ever the best format for us, and it did not tend to be conducted on the high plane that you would like to think of it during the great era of debating in America. When Campbell was just starting out, they weren't going to debate at all. Thomas, I'm sorry. I couldn't see it. It's that pole. I'm sorry. You've got a break. I'm sorry. Let's go on with my actual assignment tomorrow. Sorry. That's the first time I went over. Lately.